Next hour, you're going to sound off about this situation. But when we come back, Catherine Austin Fitz is joined with Andy Goss right here on Coast to Coast AM. Andy Goss, of course, one of the most respected monetary historians and contemporary experts on the American and international banking systems. Andy has a tremendous understanding of our monetary and economic systems and has attracted a wide following, over 1,000 television and radio appearances. Andy publishes a newsletter. He's authored Secret World of Money, Uncle Sam Cooks the Books. Andy, introduce yourself to Catherine Austin Fitz.
Oh, it's an honor to meet Catherine Fitz. I've been following her work for many years.
Very good. Catherine, Andy.
Good to be on with you, Andy. Bye.
And now, me. Hi, folks. How are you? Andy, good to have you back with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Andy, let's get your reaction to the bailout. We talked last week about where they were at. Looks like this one's going to pass. Does this one make you feel any better?
Oh, not at all. You know, you took the original language and added 380-odd pages to it. I imagine that's about, you know, one or two pages of perks for every congressman's vote that they needed.
Well, that's true. So true, so true. So now you're an expert in the banking system. Can they increase the FDIC to $250,000? And what happens if there are major bank failures? That's going to cost a fortune.
They couldn't pay right now at $100,000, so why not raise it to $5 million? It's really irrelevant. All that it's intended to do is build confidence, so that the silent bank run that's been going on for the last 3 weeks will stop. They just need people to stop taking their money out of the bank, feel comfortable.
They're doing that. They're doing that in record numbers right now, aren't they?
Indeed they are. And folks that prior to this action or this activity would have been comfortable with, you know, $150,000 in their IRA, maybe in a bank CD, are now suddenly questioning, wait a minute, is that extra $50 covered, or should I break it in half? And Quite a bunch of activity in that regard.
Catherine, let's bring you in on this situation. Andy is an expert on the banking systems. And with the both of you, and Catherine, the way you have looked at this perspective too, Andy, do you believe there's fraud involved here?
There's fraud at the very root of it, yeah. Yeah.
Andy, one question I had for you. One of my concerns with Morgan Stanley and Goldman being allowed to create bank holding companies that can now use FDIC insurance, are we now seeing this increase in the limit really as a way of using the FDIC system to finance investment banks' derivative positions through the back door?
Well, you know, they've already taken the commercial deposits of the nation into that arena.
Right.
So I imagine that this would be nothing unusual.
But wouldn't it help the investment banks raise a lot more capital, really, to swing out of the, you know, out of the banks that are making loans to small business and back into financing this crazy paper?
Indeed. You know, in fact, I've made that argument for the better part of the last 5 years, that this poaching by the investment banks in commercial banking deposits really gives them the ability to gamble. And I don't think people understand the separation that Glass-Steagall gave us that was dismantled effectively after Bill Clinton left office.
See, what I'm seeing on the ground is that it's the small banks that were conservatively managed or credit unions that are keeping the liquidity going on Main Street.
That's right. They're going to be gobbled up, aren't they?
Well, you know, I'm hopeful because one of the things, when people say to me, what can I do? I say get your money out of banks that have huge derivative positions and all this crazy stuff, and get to the banks that have real solid basic businesses that are circulating money on Main Street, because you've got to keep that liquidity going on Main Street if there's going to be anything left in the real economy.
Indeed. I've been sending folks to their state-chartered banks as a way to,
right,
to strike a blow against the system.
Right. That's a great idea.
Andy,
the idea that there are different charters issued by different levels of government is another area in which the Federal Reserve is trying to consolidate their control.
Right.
So, you know, I'd imagine it won't be long before state banks are forced to fold their way in. They've killed off the savings and loans. They're in the middle of killing the credit unions, and the state chartered banks, I imagine, would be next on the list.
Andy, why do you think Congress seems to be so willing to pass this?
Is that a joke? Are you making a funny here today?
Yes, I am.
You go to the FEC's website and you see Goldman Sachs by far the number one contributor to, you know, every member of Congress except the ones that... Yeah, just look at the bill and you can see the guys that voted against it actually took less money. Like my congressman is Scott Garrett. And I've gone through great pains to make sure Scott and I have discussions about, you know, they don't get to campaign in my yard without talking about this. And so you'll see that he voted against. And then when you look at the list of money that comes in, you'll see that, of course, he's way at the bottom in terms of who they give. So they give money, lots of it. Goldman, J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley, you name the bank or the investment bank, and you'll find their dirty little money floating around our campaign contributions.
What do you hear on the street, Andy? What are people saying to you? How do they feel?
They don't understand. If they understood, they might, you know, feel. But they don't understand. So they can't have an intelligent discussion about what's going on, who's responsible. All they know is they want something done. This is what I hear most.
Are they frustrated?
Indeed they are. That would be the adjective I would have to pick.
Catherine, it's not going to go away, is it?
No, it's not. It's not going to go away. What we're watching is a symptom, George. It's a symptom of the answer to the question of who's in charge. As long as you have a highly centralized system, which is run for the benefit of a few, as opposed to, you know, for the benefit of the quality of life for all, this is going to happen. And so the root problem, we don't have a financial problem. We have a political problem, which is ultimately a cultural and spiritual problem. And so the issues, who's in charge and who are they governing on behalf of? Because what we've just watched is the Senate vote 75% for something that the majority of American people are either against or violently against. So we've got a real governance issue as to whether we're going to be a democracy or a republic or literally something very centralized and different.
A hybrid.
Hybrid indeed. Andy, your prediction, what happens to the stock market if the House passes this?
Happy days are here.
Sure.
You know, there'll be parades in the street. The mechanism by which this money gets into circulation, though, I think that's an area that needs close scrutiny. And as I said on your program before, this virtually creates a fourth branch of government in the office of the Secretary of Treasury. And since that office is manned by, it's an outpost of Goldman Sachs, how on earth are we going to expect what Catherine brought up about, you know, Goldman going out and creating extra bank holding companies, which will allow them to come under the FDIC umbrella? I noticed they were rushing. They rushed to get into the commercial bank arena
yes.
the very moment that this bailout was suggested so that they could be first online at their former chairman's desk and, you know, what do you have for me today? Let's not forget Henry Paulson was on watch when the majority of these bogus investment vehicles were created. And let's call them what they are because the folks holding the bags out there are the pension funds and the widows and orphans and America's investors who think they have an asset. When, in fact, the money that was taken for that asset has long been divvied up amongst the Goldman Sachs partners and others, and now the empty bag that these folks are holding in the form of CDOs and other SIVs are essentially going to be piled under a giant tarp that's going to be paid for by the American taxpayer.
Goldman Sachs will probably end up buying some banking system, don't
Several.
You think?
That's what Catherine, I think, was talking about.
I just have to tell you, George and Andy, as a matter of disclosure, that I worked as a summer intern at Goldman
yes,
Sachs.
Yes, you did in 77.
1977.
You were young. You were learning the ropes. And now and then you have to go to the camp of the enemy to see how they work firsthand, right?
Well, and here's the heartbreaking thing. I can't tell you how many smart, wonderful, great, terrific people... And that's
the
horror of this is that we're watching really horrible things done by people who, if we sat down at dinner, we would think were perfectly normal.
Yeah, the firm is packed full of incredible talent.
Right.
They go out with money, obviously, that they, you know, get from thin air and buy the brightest minds and the best people in the business.
Many of whom really have not faced what they're really a part of.
Well, it's hard to do. You can imagine the
right.
the soul searching that'll be required there to, you know, leave a very, very lucrative career on principle is something that, you know, most folks can't do. And this is one of the problems in Washington is we send very bright men and women there who, as John McCain put it, you know, don't change Washington. They end up being changed by Washington and always embracing the lifestyle that comes with all of this authority.
Do you think that they're laughing behind the scenes at us, Catherine?
You know, there are a variety of different reactions. One, if you ever saw the DVD, The Smartest Guys in the Room, about Enron, there's a wonderful audio where they describe, you literally hear the Enron traders who illegally gamed the California market, putting people out of business and destroying their lives, and they thought it was funny. And you get a feeling for the arrogance, which is breathtaking. So there's a part of this where you just have people who are so lost in the bubble and so arrogant, they've forgotten. I remember when I was on Wall Street, I used to save my money like crazy because I knew that this could not possibly have anything to do with, you know, we were being paid much too much money. It didn't make any sense. And you know, but you had people who really thought that they were geniuses because we were making money, when in fact we were making money because of Fed and Treasury policy, and it was a no-brainer. So you have a lot of arrogance. The other thing is, at the very top, what I've seen is not so much arrogance, George, but just, I mean, it's all almost kind of a sadness because people are so easy to manipulate, which means if you don't, then the other cartel will, and you'll lose. So you have people who are in a prisoner's dilemma where if they don't manipulate and steal and do these things, you know, they'll lose in the game. And so, you know, it's hard when you really understand how the system works and see how easy people are to manipulate. You know, it's not that fun, but that's how the system works.
Andy, you think they're laughing at us behind the scenes?
Well, you know, I do to a certain extent, but I'll point out again that these firms are filled with people who have no idea, have no clue, and are doing the best job that they possibly can, and many of them quite idealistic. So you have the good mixed in with the bad. And speaking to what Catherine said, Americans find themselves in that same dilemma today because it's almost as if you don't participate in the inflationary debasement of the dollar by, say, you don't borrow money, you don't, you know, incur debt, you don't use your credit card, you don't use leverage, and you save your dollars either in a box under your bed or in a bank account at very worst, then, you know, you're being taken advantage of. You're the raw material for the system. And you almost have to use leverage. You have to spend money before you get it. You cannot store and save dollars because if you do, your substance is slowly eroded away. So it's the same position that Americans are in. Either use leverage, use debt, or the other people will, and in doing so, take more of your substance.
Andy, what's the situation overall with these small community banks, these one or two branch banks that are in towns and cities all around this country?
Well, the folks inside, for the most part, are terrified because, remember, they send their money into these money centers, aggregate everybody's cash and send it up to New York for them to do with what they will. And as I spoke about in one of my articles called The River of Money, and it's quite old, so you might have trouble finding it. It's about 12 years old.
On your website?
I think it might be up there. And it talked about how each night, while you're asleep, your money is somebody else's money. You know, it's on somebody else's balance sheet overnight. And then the next day when you wake up, it's back in your account or on your balance sheet through these wonders of aggregation. And it runs through the system electronically. So it's like an electronic river of money that flows up to New York every night and then back around the world every morning. That's really what they're worried about, that counterparty risk that everyone talks about, that, you know, these guys in New York are going to do something that causes that wire not to come back into that small local bank, and then that's kind of the end of that game.
Andy, the Federal Reserve, how many banking systems own it? Do we know?
I don't understand that question.
They say the Federal Reserve is is made up of private banks.
We have to stop that because, you know, so many people have picked up on this and are just hacking it to pieces. First of all, the Federal Reserve Board is a branch of government. So when your congressman stands up there and says, hey, the Federal Reserve is part of government, it's because you didn't ask him. I mean, George, of course.
No, I understand.
Your listener didn't ask him the right question. Here's the question. Are the Federal Reserve banks privately owned? And indeed they are. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York is owned by the banks within its member district. So that, those are the names, J.P. Morgan, Chase, right, Citigroup, Deutsche Bank, Hong Kong Shanghai Bank Corporation, Dresdner Bank. These are the banks that own the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. But ultimately, you'll find the links all go back to the Bank of England and to the Bank of International Settlements, the BIS, who John Kennedy referred to as the Gnomes of Zurich. And that would probably be the control mechanism.
So it's important to point out that what Treasury is proposing to do is to bail out the owners of the Federal Reserve Banks.
Of New York.
Particularly of New York.
Yeah, if you look at the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, it's a perfectly fine institution run by real great people. So, you know, the one in Atlanta is doing what it's supposed to be doing.
What about the one here in St. Louis? How's that doing?
Yeah, St. Louis Fed is, I mean, look at their balance sheet. You know, they're doing the right stuff in their district. They actually, although I would love any one of those banks rolled into the system, when you look at the polluted balance sheet of the Fed of New York, it dwarfs St. Louis, I believe, by 21 times.
Easy, yeah.
So they have, like, you know, 21 times the stink at the Bank of New York. So obviously, the lead bank in the system right now, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, is the one bank causing all the problems. If you lined all 12 of them up, that would be the one that should be going the way of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. You should go in there, take the keys, you know, and draft everyone into the public service and keep their balance sheet.
And very important point, the New York Fed is the depository for the U.S. government.
Yeah, babe.
Which means if $4 trillion is missing from the federal government has refused to do audited financial statements for more than 10 years.
That's all thanks
to the New York Fed.
That's right. That's where it went. You go looking around their closet, you might find some lost T-bills here and there.
Well, I put up an article on my blog today called 10 Reasons to Be Against the Bailout and to Say No to the Bailout. And one of them is the New York Fed member banks owe us $4 trillion or more. And so what we ought to be talking about is getting that money back to finance, you know, real investment on Main Street that can deal with this situation, as opposed to the real economy taking $1 trillion and sending it to the New York Fed banks.
Good point. And I've been attacking them from this point, and I think congressmen and senators can actually get their head around this one. You know, like you, Grandma used to send me to the store with a $20 bill and say, get a loaf of bread and a gallon of milk and buy a little something for yourself. And bring me back the change. Well, inevitably, both my pockets were stuffed with various things. I had comic books. I had played a few pinball games. She's lucky she got back 35 cents. That's the Fed of New York's deal with the federal government.
And go ahead. I'm sorry.
Catherine's correct. We haven't audited them. We haven't gone in and shaken up the book. So this is a good time to do that. We may not ever get this other opportunity, but we have to stop talking about the Federal Reserve like it's a single unit. There are 12 banks. The one bank in New York is nasty, nasty. So just like we took Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but we left Sallie Mae, we should take the Fed of New York, and maybe that would whip the other banks into line.
Andy, have you heard of an individual by the name of Leo Wanta?
Yeah, Treasury Gate, the guy with the piles of...
apparently he's got $27 trillion somewhere in a trust, and part of that money was used to topple the Soviet Union at the time.
Yeah, the Black Eagle Trust, I think it's the story from Gold.
Is this guy real?
I have no way of knowing that.
My vote is no.
I'm strictly to the get show me the money guy. So whenever anybody tells me they have assets that are real, I say, well, okay, bring me to them and show me the vault. Because it's very easy for me to put my hands on money and tell what it is. And this is part of the problem, is that you have economists who can't even agree on what money is. And if this guy has a stack of claims in a box, whether he made them himself or somebody else made them, how do you define it as money, and what component of the money supply is it? And this is really where the rubber meets the road, and it goes back to the Fed of New York and their mismanagement. They allowed the banks within their district to create fictitious claims against the money supply of the United States, and now we want to pretend that that is money.
Let's take phone calls. when we come right back. Next hour, you sound off about the $700 billion bailout. When we come back, we'll take your phone calls with Catherine Austin Fitz and Andy Gauss right here on Coast to Coast AM. Andy, I think Henry Paulson may be involved in a gross conflict of interest, especially with Goldman Sachs. And I also think, and it's not been widely publicized, the AIG insurance situation. I think Goldman Sachs had a lot of money that they could have lost. Weren't they a major player with that company?
Indeed, and with Bear Stearns. You know, in fact, it's these credit default swaps and these other structured investment vehicles. If you go to Wikipedia and look up CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, or credit default swaps, you'll find that they were virtually invented under Henry Paulson's watch. So, obviously, you could make a case for conflict of interest there.
Catherine, do you agree?
Yeah, significant conflict of interest. And the part of the challenge is how do you get someone for that position who has the knowledge and experience who doesn't have significant conflicts of interest?
Well, you make sure you own the Fed, right? And then you can pluck them out of that. So a lot of my colleagues suggest abolishing the Federal Reserve. And while we were starting from scratch, I could easily make that case. To abolish them now or to rip them out of your body right now would be akin to, you know, grabbing a hold of that tumor with a pair of pliers and just yanking it off. You're going to cause some damage. And so to move in and just take over the institution, assimilate, get our people in there, get career politicians or career bureaucrats at least in there who are going to do the job for a tenth of what these guys do it for and are going to learn and do it better. That will be the feeding ground, I believe, and the breeding ground for our future secretaries of the Treasury, right from our own farm team, so to speak. Let's make the Federal Reserve Bank of New York really a federal institution like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac now, and I think we could really make a difference because we could eliminate just the interest that we pay on circulating notes or the interest on this $700 billion package. Somebody think about that for a minute. The mechanism is going to be like this. Congress is going to write a bond, essentially, or tranches of bonds that say, I owe you $700 billion on a paper bag. They're going to hand that over to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. They're going to create $700 billion and loan it back to Henry Paulson.
Jeez.
And then he's going to write checks for that money to his institution. So not only are they going to get paid by getting all of their bad debt redeemed, but then the Fed is going to get paid in the form of interest payments on the $700 billion. It's insane to do it.
How do we get in on this club, Andy?
Exactly. So if the government is not going to nationalize the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, maybe the three of us should take it over.
Let's go to Lauren in Seattle, first-time caller. You're on with Andy Gauss and Catherine Austin Fitz. Go ahead, Lauren.
Hi, George. I'm just calling. Of course, I'm up in Seattle. I'm a first-time caller, long-time listener, very excited to have gotten through. I study naturopathic medicine up here in Seattle, and of course, I'm a graduate student, and a lot of the issues with the stock market right now and the economy in general kind of point to an older generation. I'm in my 20s, and I am living off federally funded graduate loans and probably eventually graduate plus loans, and I'm just curious about what these issues in the economy have in store for the people who are living day-to-day off borrowed money, off educational funds.
I've never heard of that before. Catherine, have you?
Catherine has, yeah.
Sure. When students take on significant student loans, they have fixed income payments and debt coming due, and we're going into an environment where expenses are rising and incomes are falling. And so it's a pincer movement, and I would encourage you, anything you can do to not take on more debt or to start to amortize the debt, even if it means really changing how you live and your living arrangements, would be a very good idea, because we're going into an environment where having more debt than you can afford to carry is a dangerous thing.
Well, it's what happened in the mortgage with that crisis.
Yeah, it would be a shame for them to foreclose on you and take all of that knowledge back, see?
So. Yeah, that's right.
Well, it really has. I think one of the most politically offensive things happening in the United States today is we have literally fraudulently induced an entire generation of young people to take on debt which we know they cannot afford. And what I would love to do is see emerge a group of attorneys who are willing to take the case to court that this is fraudulent inducement, and that debt ought to be written down as a result.
Oh, that's brilliant. I would support that effort because I agree with you 100%. In fact, I don't see why it isn't done in the form of direct grants.
It should be.
It should be, you know, because putting money into our youth, and especially a brilliant person like the caller here who's, you know, going into the field of helping us get old and understands managing symptoms is not the way to fix a problem, that's the type of stuff we want to grant money for. We shouldn't have to put these people on the hook so that they improve their minds at the expense of a lifetime.
When you spend money to bail out Wall Street out of derivative positions, you're encouraging bad behavior. But when we invest in the education of our young people, that's one of the best things we can do for an economy, and that's an investment that can afford to pay down the general debt. Peter Drucker and others have really made a very compelling case that all the money we've ever spent as a society on education has come back to us many times GNP and stronger economy.
Yeah, no doubt. And you've done a lot for that, right? Weren't you on the advisory board for Sallie Mae as well, right?
Yeah, I was on the board of Sallie Mae, and one of the things I was going to mention apropos of this conversation, I'll never forget getting a wonderful presentation by the finance staff on the use of derivatives by Sallie Mae.
Right.
And as the board asked questions, what we discovered is here was a board including seven vice chairmen of the top banks in the country, and no one understood how these things worked.
Right. And this is still the key today. I think people can't understand why this debt is radioactive and toxic. It has to do with the different tranches that were created and the different categories of risk. And so now that imagine what they've done is they've taken these pool of mortgages and they've changed them at the atomic level so that now they can't be put back together, sort of like the fly.
Right.
And since you can't put them back together, you can't put them all in one place to bail them out. So what can you do? To move them all out in a field and cover them with a tarp. That's it. You can't do anything.
Andy, when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, we had one community where 70% of the mortgages in that community were in default and owned by Fannie and FHA.
70%.
And that's the time I said to my staff, George, I said, listen, have the community buy the mortgages.
Yeah.
And my staff said, well, they don't have any money. And I said, well, I'm from Wall Street. We never had any money.
Yeah.
We just created an entity and swapped stock.
Right.
And those, you watch, the best way to work out a lot of these defaulted assets, because it's not just mortgages, it's all sorts of stuff, including real estate, everything else, is to optimize by place and to use equity vehicles where a community could buy everything and swap stock and work it out in a way that builds new jobs, new income, and as Andy rightly pointed out, these derivatives now make it much harder to do.
Okay, let's go to Sean in Santa Barbara, California. Go ahead, Sean.
Hi, George. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Sean.
Instead of bailing out these bums, how about paying our debt to China and then have the WPA, CC camps, then have a new bill called the Pretty Boy Floyd Bill. And then, like Pretty Boy Floyd did, he used to rob banks. I'm not saying robbing banks, but he would buy it, get the mortgages, and give them back to the farmers. We give it back to the people and then put these bums in prison and all of them.
Well, I made the case on, I think, our last time we spoke, George, about how you could pay off every defaulted mortgage in America for $100 billion.
Yeah.
And now, you know, I...
Cheap. It was cheap.
It was cheap. And to be fair, I was using figures from the third quarter of 2007. So I looked at the flow of funds accounts of the United States from the Fed today, their latest statistical release, and the number is actually $144 billion. Forgive
Still
me.
Still cheap compared to $700 billion.
And that's not just every foreclosed mortgage. That's every defaulted mortgage. That means if you're 90 days past due, you're on the list. So not only could you take care of all the foreclosures, but everyone who's facing foreclosure by being 90 days past due could also be covered with $144 billion. So let's stop blaming the homeowners that are not paying their mortgage, and let's start thinking about the 93% of people that are paying their mortgage and recognize that it's still the best way to deal with that entire system is to really leave Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac part of government like they were. In fact, I would fund them with Social Security trust funds. And use that money because, you know, 30-year retirement money and 30-year mortgage money are matches made in heaven.
How do you think Paulson approached President Bush to get him online with this?
I think he may have had a gun in his pocket. The reality is that the Bush family's finances are so tied into Wall Street. Remember, Brown Brothers, Harriman, Prescott mm-hmm, Bush, and mm-hmm. the entire family fortune is based upon the fortunes of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Brown Brothers, Harriman is headquartered right around the corner and still the largest and only, I believe, private bank existing. So,
and doing well, I take it.
Quite well, yes. So their fortunes, the family fortunes are tied in. I imagine he had no trouble at all convincing Mr. Bush that this was the right thing to do.
Springfield, Mass. Rick, go ahead. You're on with us. Go ahead, Rick. Well, there's
we might have Rick now.
We might have. How about Lisa in Hendersonville, North Carolina? Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi. I'm actually a first-time caller, and I've been listening since, well, Art Bell back in 96.
Well, thanks for staying with us so long.
Your show is amazing, and I appreciate it so much. I basically wanted to say on the topic that you're talking about tonight that I believe that everything we're using right now is it's counterfeit, basically, because we use plastic cards. We have paper money that's really can't even be backed up by the Federal Reserve. And to me, what true currency, if you want to talk about money and survival, would be clean air, and, you know, clean water, and more of a harmonious world. And I believe what we're going into is like an Armageddon within our own, you know, time on Earth right now. And basically, I just wanted to make that comment. And how do you feel about our money situation, you know, as far as being, it's almost like a counterfeit thing.
Yeah. In fact, I point this out as often as I can. When people predict that we're heading towards a cashless society, I would say that 94% of everything that we call money doesn't exist. It's merely a book entry. Only 6% is in printed coin or cash. You're talking less than $1 trillion. Now, although Americans put another $24 billion in circulation this week by going to their bank and saying, give me my money, and then who knows, they've stuck it in a shoebox somewhere, they are no more secure by holding that piece of paper than they were having an electronic deposit. Just like 1929, there's definitely not enough paper money. So go to the real money, what the Constitution defines as money, and you'll feel secure. I agree with you, too, about, you know, it's more important. There are more important things than money in this world. And as long as you have enough to care for your family and you've stored your future needs, your current work for your future needs, store it in the form that the Constitution describes. Gold and silver coin, you know, quarters, dimes, half, silver dollars, that's the real money of this nation. And I think your perception that the rest is not real is a very accurate one.
I flew up to San Jose this weekend for a conference, Andy and Catherine, and on Southwest, people were ordering drinks on the plane. No more cash. They're just using credit cards. Yes. They've got these little tiny readers.
Do you take cash? Used to be a joke. Whenever I did it, everybody would laugh, you know, the crowd would laugh. But now, go into an establishment and ask them if they take cash. You will get a serious response, like, okay, that's a legitimate question. Yes, we do, especially in New York City.
George, one of the things I wanted to mention in response to the last question is when I did an actuarial study as the Assistant Secretary of Housing, in 1989 we're losing $11 million a day in the single-family fund. And the question I had is, what could we do to most improve the value of the mortgages and the collateral homes in the FHA portfolio? And what I discovered was the single most important thing we could do is get the popsicle index to go up. And let me explain what the popsicle index is, because it's kind of something that my staff and I invented at the time. The popsicle index is the percent of people in a community who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a popsicle, and come home alone safely. And it's simply just a rule of thumb for the human intimacy and sense of well-being and safety and community in a place. And what we discovered is where the popsicle index is high, the value of the real estate is high. And the value of the small businesses is high because you don't have all the crime and all the dysfunction and all the various problems. And in that environment, small business and income tends to grow and develop, and you have health in a lot of ways, including economic health. And what we found after sort of studying the situation for several decades is that as the Dow Jones has gone up, the Popsicle Index has gone down. And the way government money is engineered is very much at the heart of that. And the opportunity before us is, can we figure out a way that we can realign the Popsicle Index with the Dow Jones Index so that they go up together and they give energy to each other? Because right now, what's good for the big financial organizations and big corporations and what's good for people and the natural environment are very dangerously out of alignment.
Okay, Peggy in Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Peggy.
Hello, George.
Welcome.
I read this whole bill, believe it or not, the second one, and I came to a different conclusion. You keep hearing all this $700 billion thing, but what I see is looks like a hostile corporate takeover of our economic system, with the review board being kind of like the fox in the hen house.
Right.
You know, I mean, and Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan on board, as soon as this goes through, to go after our regional banks.
Yep. I like Section 10.
Over America.
It's a financial coup d'etat.
Yeah, Section 10 gives the Secretary of the Treasury unreviewable power. No one can sue him for any decision that he makes.
Well, not only that, but he can also say what the troubled assets are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And he describes them in one part, but then in the next part, it's kind of like
any other asset.
What else I decide?
Yeah.
And there's no particular plan on how they're going to separate this all out and sell it. It's going to be less, as much transparency as it was when this started.
Yep.
So this whole thing makes no sense unless it's a takeover.
I couldn't agree more.
And that's what it should be. And here at the last minute, it's up to us, although, again, I doubt that the House will listen, but taking over, nationalizing the Federal Reserve Bank of New York will get us at the books and at the heart of the matter. Now, the cynical colleagues of mine suggest, well, then they'll just move their operations to another Federal Reserve Bank and you'll have to take control of that one. Perhaps. But until they do, certainly we can find out where the bodies are buried in this one.
Hey, Gil in Canada, go ahead, east of the Rockies.
Hi, George.
Hey.
I'm just, like, aside from, like, the economic side, like the bigger thing seems about, like, the greed of the whole aspect of it. And I'm wondering, like, how you can actually take this in, like, a whole broader, like, aspect. And, like, even for, like, myself, I moved to, like, New York. My family came from India. We didn't have that much money. And then I got, like, a great job down there. I'm making, like, $90,000. And then I even see it in my own company how greed affects you. So when this initially happened, like the mortgage and all that kind of stuff, the people around me, they were secure with their jobs. They were happy with the situation. They were like, wow, the houses are going down. We can buy houses for really cheap. They're going to go way up later. So this is a good thing for us. And this is at, like, a smaller level. So, like, with the Goldman Sachs and, like, the bigger government side, how do you approach it there?
I think Catherine... Catherine just touched on that with her Popsicle Index. You know, that's what you're saying, is that this influx of cheap, easy money, counterfeit money, as the caller put it, has really created a culture where, you know, everything's cheap and worthless, and including human life and our feelings for each other. So.
We'll be back. We'll let you sound off next on Coast to Coast AM.